Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Anna Quinlan, whose latest book is Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. Earlier books include A Short Guide to a Happy Life, six novels, including Object Lessons, One True Thing, and most recently, Every Last One. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Journalism. Anna Quinlan, this book is subtitled A Memoir. It's not a memoir. It's a collection of essays about aging and about what it is like being a boomer approaching the age of 60, looking back on your life. But it's not a memoir. Why did they put that down?
Well, first of all, I think they were looking for a place to put it. You know, there's always a challenge in bookstores. If it's not a memoir, is it simply nonfiction? Is it a collection of essays, but they all sort of hold together? I actually originally had called it a memoir of aging, and of aging came off because apparently it's kind of a downer. So I think there's always a challenge about where a book fits, and it's become a kind of an odd challenge for me because, of course, originally I was a reporter and a columnist who started writing novels. That's how I was seen. Now, for lots of readers, I'm seen as a novelist who has strayed into nonfiction. To the extent that I appear to readers to be neither fish nor fowl, I think my publisher was thinking of a way to signal about which dish we were dealing with here.
This is weird. On Wikipedia, it says you were born July 8, 1952. On IMDb, it says you were born July 8, 1953.
Well, I just got the Wikipedia one fixed 2 weeks ago. It is 1952. They used to have 1953, too. And I may be one of the few women in America who spun her wheels relentlessly to get Wikipedia to make her a year older, because as a reporter, having it wrong was driving me insane. I tried to edit it, and then I get back an email saying, you have edited an entry that is about a subject with which you may have a conflict of interest. Therefore, we cannot accept your edit. And I'm thinking, it's me.
Anna Quinlan, you were one of the first women reporters. At 18, you were copy girl. Were you the first copy girl?
Oh, no, no, no. There were many copy girls before me. You know, there were female reporters before me. I think that I was particularly lucky that when I became a columnist, it was at a moment where the second stage women's movement had made it possible to be sort of flagrantly female in print. And so, for example, the New York Times, my two predecessors, Anne O'Hare McCormick and Flora Lewis, on the op-ed page, both covered foreign affairs, and both, I think, would say themselves that if you took their bylines off of it, there would be no reason for you to assume that a woman had written that column. That wasn't true of me, and to some extent, that was a gift of timing, that I came along at a moment when it was safe and appropriate to do that.
And Gail Collins has said something similar, that she was there at the right moment, because if it had been a little bit later, she wouldn't have been the first, and a little bit before, she wouldn't have gotten the gig.
Yeah, and she's one of my favorite columnists now because she does a masterful job of writing a really funny column about something. Frequently, we don't ask humor columnists to amount to much in terms of their political or social commentary. Gail's the person who pulls it all together, I think.
Anna Quinlan, in 1983, you became the deputy Metropolitan editor. Had there been women on that particular desk?
No, I was the highest-ranking woman at the paper when I became deputy Metro editor.
In terms of glass ceilings, what were your feelings? How far did you think you could rise? What was going on at that particular time?
Well, the women's suit against the New York Times was settled in 1976, and a whole lot of us were hired as a response to the settlement of that class action suit. So there was a kind of a powerful impulse to push women forward, to have them rise. But as is the case with many great American institutions, that impulse frequently seemed to take the form of focusing on one or two women and moving them along. For a variety of reasons, I was one of those women. And so there was a sense that there was an upward trajectory planned for me. And in fact, I would argue that that's exactly what happened when I became an op-ed page columnist, which I think of as the dream job at the New York Times.
And you did that for several years. Why did you leave it?
I'm the kind of person who likes to do something until she feels really competent at it and then do something else that scares the bejesus out of her. I felt like I had gotten quite competent at writing an opinion column and that I didn't want to be one of those people who 10 years later was thinking, didn't I once write this exact same column X number of years ago?
Well, unlike Gail Collins, you were not going to deal with the political moments of the day. She's always got something new because there's always something weird going on except for Romney and the dog on his car.
Right, which we love, by the way. I have a T-shirt that says dogs are not baggage. But actually, I think even if you're dealing with politics, as a columnist, you're always in danger if you stay around long enough of repeating yourself and also of riding your political hobby horses unrelentingly. I mean, I think we have all read columnists about whom we can say when we look at that day's column, oh, this again. And I did not want to be an oh, this again.
So you left, became a novelist, and now you're getting back into these essays are similar to the kinds of essays you wrote at the Times. Why did you choose to go back to, it's not the same format, it's in a book, but why did you choose to go back to those same themes now?
You know, I never had an intention of returning to nonfiction. I've been very satisfied being a fiction writer. I find it very challenging. But two things came together at critical moments over the last couple of years. The first was that when I was working on my farewell column at Newsweek, I did some reporting and discovered that the average life expectancy of an American in the year I was born, 1952, was 68. And I found that astonishing. And when I told other people about it, they found it astonishing. And, of course, our life expectancy today is around 80. So we've gained about 12 years just during my lifetime. I found that really intriguing. And the second thing is that after a storm at our house in Pennsylvania, my daughter called me very concerned that I might have been injured. And I said to her sort of unthinkingly, honey, I'm too old to die young now. And at that moment, I realized that I was at a place in the continuum that I hadn't quite apprehended until that moment, and that there were probably a lot of people, including the same women who had responded so viscerally to my Life in the 30s columns at the Times, who were at that moment, too, and trying to make sense of it. And it just seemed to me that it was a natural for a book.
And when did you start writing it?
I think it was about 2.5 years ago. I'm very bad at remembering, you know, when I do things and how long they take, but it was something like that.
And you just thought of these things and said, hey, I'm going to try tackling nonfiction again?
Yeah. I'm real comfortable with nonfiction. It's just that fiction pushes me in a way that nonfiction doesn't anymore because, of course, I've been writing nonfiction for so many years. And I was happy doing one novel after another, but it just seemed to me that this was a reasonable interlude, especially given the fact that it would be published right around the time of my 60th birthday.
It used to be that 60 was kind of the beginning of semi-old age, and 65 was old age. And I notice that now the 50s can extend to as late as 70, and the 70s can sometimes, or the 60s can sometimes extend to as late as 90. My mother's 88, still drives around New York, goes to plays and everything, and that would have been her at 73, not at 85 or 86.
That's absolutely true, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because I don't think in an organized way we've thought about the fact that the entire number line of getting older has shifted. And clearly, it's partially a function of the actuarial charts that have given us a significantly longer life expectancy. And part of it is the way we're choosing to live and the way we're taking care of ourselves. I mean, 65 used to be the mandatory retirement age, and everyone used to congratulate themselves. Isn't it wonderful? You get to retire. Well, we all know that a significant number of us have said, 65? I'm not retiring at 65. I have another good 20 years ahead of me, I want to keep working. So that whole way of living in the world, what you're talking about with your mother still driving well into her 80s, what we're talking about after 60 and still continuing to work, it's just a different way of living as an older person than, say, a generation or two ago.
Well, I keep thinking that a lot of people of our age would start thinking in terms of valedictories, and I'm interested in challenges. I'm not interested in valedictories, and I wasn't interested in them 10 years ago either.
I think that that's true of most people our age, that there's a sense that this is nowhere near a final chapter. The interesting thing, which I explore in the book, is that we don't really have a name for it because, frankly, I feel like I'm a little too old to be middle-aged. But I don't feel like I'm either old or elderly, but I don't know what the name is for whatever I am right now. Gerontologists will say they came up with these classifications, so we're the young old. The young old is 55 to 70, I think. And then you have the old old, who are over 70. And lots of the people I know who are older, over 70, would really object to being called not only old, but old old.
You know, I was thinking you're good friends with Stephen Sondheim. And when I spoke to him 6 months ago, I was saying, you working on any projects? And he said, oh, I've got 3 projects going right now that I'm starting to think about, 3 new musicals. I'm thinking the man is 82 years old, and he's talking about projects that will take him up to the age of 90 or beyond. That would have been unthinkable 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's true, but actually that is accurate, what he said to you, at least from what I know of what he's working on. He has one advantage, which is he comes from genetic stock that seems to be long-lived, and another that he's in excellent shape in every conceivable way as an 82-year-old, and finally because he still gets so excited about his work. And I think that's the key for so many of us. I mean, I don't think, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful to not ever have to write anything again and to just, I don't know, do good works. I'm not sure what I would do with myself. I'm a writer. I write. That's what I'm going to do, probably into perpetuity.
What do you think this has to do with being boomers? Does it have to do with technology? Does it have to do with the fact that we've learned how to take care of ourselves? You do a power walk every day. I do aerobics in my house. You know, next time I go to Hawaii, I'm still going to go body surfing.
Yeah, I do think in terms of being physical, at least some of us are doing things that are quite different from what our grandparents or our great-grandparents did. Now, we've got to account for the fact that there's a lot of America who doesn't do that. As I say in the book, you know, we find ourselves between obesity and anorexia because America never seems to be able to do anything halfway. But I think we are taking care of ourselves more, and I think we're thinking of our lifespan in a different way. I mean, we're just thinking there's more. I mean, the very end of the book is to be continued. And I think most people our age think of that themselves that way, to be continued.
Well, you also say toward the end of the book, I can't imagine what I'll be like at 80. And then I think about what I thought I'd be like at 60 when I was 40. And I couldn't have predicted that I'd basically be 40 at 60.
I don't really feel like I ever thought of myself as 60. I look ahead more now than I ever did before, but I have a feeling that when I was younger, I thought of myself as perpetually younger, and there is a little element of shock to discovering that I'm 60.
Some people have said that the problem with the boomers is that they're perpetually immature and they've never grown up. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
No, I mean, I think the problem with the boomers is that we frequently act as though we've invented the wheel. And certainly I felt like I was in danger of doing that in this book. I mean, we're the generation that insisted that young was always better and that said we shouldn't trust anyone over 30. And now we're the generation that's going to insist that old is actually better and that youth is wasted on the young. Look, to some level, we're entitled. We're the largest demographic bump in American history. On the other hand, if all over America, other people are saying, God save me from the boomers setting the national agenda yet again, I will understand completely.
Anna Quinlan, speaking of that, you know, if anybody had said to me that back when I was in college or thereafter, that my generation would be the generation that gave us Ronald Reagan as president and the Tea Party, I think we were huge failures.
Well, understanding politics means always understanding that for every action, there will be a reaction. I mean, I feel as though the greatest social revolution in the history of this country has been my great benefactor, and that's the changes in the lives of women during the last 100 years. And my life would have been impossible without second wave feminism. But of course, I look at second wave feminism and think we changed things so much in such a short period of time that pushback was inevitable.
Can you define first and second?
Well, the first wave feminism, where we're talking in America, we're talking about the right to vote at the turn of the century. Okay. and the changes to various laws, and then the resurgence in the 1960s of parity and equality under the law, but in the workplace and in the home too.
That's also changed for a lot of younger women who at this point might not know exactly where to turn.
I think younger women are going gangbusters. At least my experience with actually having some responsibility over a younger woman who's 23, my daughter Maria, is that they're reaping so many of the benefits of second wave feminism. I mean, there's a moment in the book where I say that Maria was watching the news with me and she turned to me and said, "Has a man ever been Secretary of State?" At that moment, when I realized that she'd only known Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, and Hillary Clinton, I suddenly thought she has grown up in a completely different America than I grew up in, and God bless it.
Well, there was also Colin Powell in there, too, but that also means that lives of black people have changed.
Right.
Lives of gay people have completely transformed,
changed.
Even more, I think, than women.
Which totally goes to explain something like the Tea Party. I mean, when you change social mores so radically during what is really a relatively short period of time. I mean, I was doing a piece about nomenclature for a special anniversary edition of the Times a couple of years ago, and I went back to the 50s and found pieces in the newspaper of record that referred to police arrests of a group of deviants at a bar in Greenwich Village. It was so shocking to me that the New York Times would refer to people who happened to be gay as deviants in print. And I thought, God, to live in this new world where people across the board seem to get so much more of a fair shake, it's so wonderful, but it inevitably gives rise to the kind of pushback that something like the Tea Party espouses.
I interviewed Christopher Bram, who had recently written a book about the history of gay literature. And the most shocking thing to me in reading it, and his most shocking point in writing it, was the casual, nasty homophobia of people like Kaufman, Walter Kerr in the Times, toward gay playwrights like Tennessee Williams or Edward Albee. And it was so casual, as if this is fine to say that a play like Virginia Woolf is just two fags having it out.
That's what I was struck by in these pieces that I read in the Times in the 50s, that there was no sense of malice in this characterization. It just was the way things were. But from my perspective, it was like each time I came to the word, it was like getting a little electric shock between my shoulder blades.
Anna Quinlan, let's talk about some other elements. You talk about girlfriends and the importance of having girlfriends for women. Do you think there's something uniquely different about that than men having male friends?
Well, as I say in the book, there's a kind of a landmark psychological study that shows that men consider male friendship as important as women consider female friendship. But what they count as friendship differs considerably. Men consider friendship doing things with another person, going to the theater with somebody, having dinner with someone, you know, going fishing or watching television or something. Women consider friendship talking about stuff. It doesn't even have to take place in person. It can be completely on the telephone. And I do find in my experience with being the mother to both men and women and having many male as well as female friends, that that tends to hold true. That women in their friendships tend to deconstruct the world verbally and men tend to be more interested in companionship that doesn't necessarily include that. women like to sort of take the world apart and put it back together again. I remember when I was first given the assignment to do the column that was called Life in the 30s, Abe Rosenthal, the executive editor who invented it, gave me only one piece of direction. He said, write about what you're talking about with your friends on the telephone. And I do think that to some extent he was trying to tap into a particularly female thing of trying to make sense of the world through conversation.
I'm going to read you a quote. One of the greatest glories of growing older is the willingness to ask why and getting no good answer, deciding to follow my own inclinations and desires. Asking why is the way to wisdom. Do you think younger people don't ask why?
I think younger people think that there are rules. There is the way things are meant to be done. And that too often the rules are set either by the peer group or by that great inchoate they out there that we all know about, you know, that somehow says young women have to be really thin and their heels have to be really high and young men have to try to bed as many people as they can in as short a period of time as they can without emotional engagement, so that they're more likely to follow the pack. And I find that as people get older, they're more likely to say, you know what, I'm not doing that anymore. I just don't care. If you don't like it. I mean, I once wrote a column about my daughter when she was 5, where I said that at one point she looked at me and said, I don't care, very casually. And I got many critical letters from readers saying, if your daughter is saying that, it means you're doing something wrong as a mother, because I was clearly admiring of it. And one of the things that strikes me about this moment in my life is that I'm more like my 5-year-old self than I ever was before, in that my 5-year-old self didn't know that there were ways she was supposed to be or act or think. She just sort of was. And I think that's why Maria said, I don't care that day to me. And I think it's why I say I don't care about so many things now.
Is that necessarily a question of age or just a question of the fact that, you know, you were able to throw off rigidity? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, my grandparents talked to me about they always keep their hair short. They don't listen to that horrible music you listen to. My parents always used the they thing. My mother, in particular, still kind of uses the they thing. They think this is a good play. They think this is a good movie. And I wonder if maybe it has more to do with our generation's ability to throw off the idea of expertise.
Well, that may be the case, and it certainly has felt to me like it's happened as I've gotten older, that I've been less terrorized by the they. But, you know, Gloria Steinem once said that women are the only group who become more radical with age. And I found that with a lot of older women I know, women who are a generation or two removed from me, that suddenly they have this kind of kick-ass, I'm going to do and say what feels good to me attitude, which I deeply admire.
There's another quote, which is, somehow I think the canyon dividing the generations is deeper for women. Why?
Part of it is because the voices of criticism and self-criticism, I think, are much louder and more persistent for women when they're young. There's a constant drumbeat from television, from advertising, from other women, from women's magazines about how you should look and how you should behave and how you should be. What that means is that the mores of one set of women seem like a rebuke to another set. I mention in there an encounter I had at a college where a young woman stood up and said, we're not going to make the same mistakes that you made. And, of course, all I could think was, no, you're not. You're going to make different mistakes. And, of course, that's what always happens across the generations. But I think sometimes it's very difficult for us to talk across that divide because so much of it winds up sounding like criticism, and we're all so bloody sick of criticism.
Counter a little bit to that is that when I go back to New York and see my old friends that I grew up with, we were a neighborhood and we still know each other to some degree. The men look terrible, but the women all look gorgeous.
Well, it's good to hear that. Although, I don't know. I think some of the older men I know look pretty darn good. But I do think that, again, we're under this incredible pressure, which we internalize. I mean, if you just look at the variety of face creams available, you feel like you're going to lose your mind, whereas I think a man who moisturizes is few and far between.
I moisturize.
Well, there you go.
In light of what you just said, you have another quote, "We have embalming disguised as grooming."
We've all seen it. We've all seen the person who once looked one way and now looks completely different, either in the public eye or sometimes friends or family or neighbors. You know, and even if they're not going to go over the knife, there's a spate of fake tanning, which I don't quite understand since everybody seems to be a very odd color of orange. And, you know, all sorts of attempts to stop the clock. And one of the great things, one of the salvations of having a 23-year-old daughter is I look at Maria and I know there is not a doctor on earth who is good enough to make me look like her, because youth has a particular patina that's unmistakable. I mean, Maria looks like somebody just took her out of the plastic. And there's nothing that you can do about that, nor would you want to. I mean, I see pictures of Meryl Streep when she was in Sophie's Choice, and her beauty is breathtaking. At the same time, I might add, as casting directors were telling her, she was not pretty enough, her nose was too big, she was too odd looking. But I see her today, and I think she looks fabulous. It's just a different kind of fabulous. And I hope we're getting to the point where we can love both kinds of fabulous, I guess. You know, it goes back to that old line. I emailed Gloria Steinem because I wanted to use that famous line of hers where she said, "This is what blank looks like." And I thought it was someone said to her, "You don't look 50. And she said, "This is what 50 looks like." She said, "Oh, no, it's bad enough in our ageist culture. It was 40. It was 40 when someone said to me, "I don't look 40. Well, now she's over 75, and that's what over 75 looks like. But I don't think that we have a set-in-stone sense anymore of what specific ages look like. When I think of my grandparents over 60, even in their 50s, they looked like old people. And it wasn't just that they looked like old people. They dressed like old people. They moved like old people. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest shifts, that there's an entire way of presenting yourself that doesn't have to be young, because there's nothing that makes me crazier than what the Brits call mutton dressed as lamb. You know, the 60-year-old woman who looks like she's wearing a 30-year-old's clothes and maybe a simulated 30-year-old's face. But this kind of, you know, way of dressing and looking and being that 60-something, but that looks great. I mean, you mentioned Meryl and Diane Keaton. There's two women who look somewhat different than their younger selves, who have not had any work done, but who have this kind of, I think, beauty and incredible character in their face. I mean, Keaton just looks so much like a specific human being. I just love that.
I've noticed that Jane Fonda seems to have had some work done, and I'm thinking, why?
She actually has, I think, has spoken publicly about the fact that right before this newest book came out, she had, I don't know if she had a full facelift or just her eyes done or something, but there's a certain kind of actress who thinks of herself as a leading lady, and there's a certain kind of actress who, even if she is a leading lady, thinks of herself as a character actress. Meryl thinks of herself as a character actress.
So she doesn't.
Diane Keaton thinks of herself as a character actress. But Jane Fonda is from Hollywood royalty, and I think she thought of herself as a big star, hence you always have to look a certain way. I know.
All of this talk about our generation getting older, and there are a lot of young people listening to this. A number of them are saying right now, as they slam the radio down, why don't those old people get out of the way for us? How do you feel about that?
I am totally sympathetic to it. I mean, there used to be a progression. When I went to work in the New York Times newsroom, every year, three or four guys would retire because it was a mandatory retirement age. And that made room for younger people to move up into certain beats and for other younger people to be hired as general assignment reporters. And whether we like to talk about it or not, when baby boomers say, I'm not retiring, what that means is that we create an enormous bottleneck in the workplace, which is a problem for people who are younger than we are.
It's particularly a problem in a slow and crappy economy.
Exactly, exactly. It just exacerbates that. And quite frankly, when we talk in such a self-congratulatory way publicly about the fact that we don't intend to retire, I know that there are lots of younger people who feel like their backs go up about that, who think, well, okay, how am I ever going to get a foot up?
This is happening at places like right here at KPFA, where the older people, a lot of them, are sticking around. The boomers have nowhere to go. They're sticking around, and a lot of the younger people are saying, when is our turn? And those younger people might be turning 40.
Look, I'm really sympathetic to this. The one good thing is that there's an entire new mechanism for people who want to write or broadcast or do films or radio, and it's called the Internet. And they seem to have cornered the market on certain aspects of that. Not coincidentally, it also doesn't pay much if it pays at all, so it leaves them, you know, poor and struggling. And I'm very sympathetic to this, in part because, let's face it, I am the mother of a 28-year-old, a 26-year-old, and a 23-year-old, and it's a challenge for them and their friends.
So what do we as boomers do about it? We're not going to retire. We're not going to get out of the way.
I'm not sure everybody's not going to get out of the way. The out-of-the-way line comes directly from a Newsweek column I wrote in 2009 saying, in fact, I was getting out of the way, that I was looking for younger voices, that I felt that the pundit class in America was too male, too gray, and too white, and that I'd like to see that change. I haven't seen that change very much, but I think more and more, particularly among women, you see women who can afford it embracing philanthropy. It's kind of interesting for me because, you know, when we first got out into the world, a lot of us had mothers who were volunteers. They didn't want to work outside the home at paying jobs, or they couldn't work outside the home and paying jobs. So they volunteered at schools and hospitals and other institutions. Now I think after our lives of paying work, a lot of us are saying, you know what? I'd like to do a little good here. And I've been involved in a number of philanthropies which have been really satisfying to me. And I can envision a life in which I write somewhat less and give back somewhat more. And I know some other women who are feeling the same way. So that might take some of the stress off for those younger people trying to move into the workplace.
Do you think that the Occupy movement is partially a generational thing?
I suppose so. I mean, again, I'm very sympathetic to any movement that says income inequality in the United States is out of control. I mean, I'm very sympathetic. All you have to do is look at the data in terms of the disconnect between how much money CEOs and top executives make and how much money line workers make, and also the disconnect between the now fabled 1% and the 99%. I'm very sympathetic to arguments about income inequality.
I also noticed something, too, that the people who cry loudest about the debt and having to save America for future generations are people in their 60s. People in their 20s say, we want jobs.
Yeah, they do. But the good news about that kind of age span is that some of the social issues that still seem to rankle Americans now are going to evaporate over the course of the next 20 to 30 years. Because, for example, if you look at poll figures on support for gay marriage, the opposition is almost all or is largely, say, over 50 or 60, and the support is all under 30. So that for kids of my kids' generation, it's a complete non-issue, which means that in 25 or 30 years, their kids are going to be saying, you people actually argued about this?
So why is the abortion issue still a problem? I thought we'd have been over that 30 years ago.
Yeah, I thought we would have too. I thought we would have at least reached some stasis about it. It's just a real hot-button issue, although, again, the polls show that younger people are much less exercised about it than their elders are. And I still continue to think that a whole lot of it has to do with really opposition to freedom for women. I think so much of it has to do with controlling your own fertility. The Jack in the Box came out a little bit during the Republican primary when you could see Rick Santorum saying some things that really made it clear that he was opposed to contraception because we should all be homeschooling our kids as opposed to taking jobs from able-bodied men.
Do you think that in the November election, not trying to put any pressure on you, do you think that there is this silent women's vote that will vote Democratic even if they say they're voting Republican?
No, I don't think it's a silent vote, and I don't think polls show that they say they're voting Republican. I think the lion's share of white suburban women, which is an important voting bloc, will go for the president overwhelmingly.
The other issue that is really concerning younger people, like my nieces and nephews, is global climate change, and that seems to be behind a lot of this, and no one's talking about it.
Yeah, I know. The economy has really pushed that into the background. I think we were making some significant progress on a public conversation about that 2003, 2004, 2005. And then when the crash came, you know, when it's a question of keeping the skies clean or providing jobs, for most Americans, the answer is pretty unequivocally jobs. And then each time there's a boom again, we find ourselves in the position of having taken two steps back and maybe taking one step forward on that issue.
This is nothing to do necessarily with that, but since I've got you here as a former New York Times reporter, let me ask you, there's been this, and it began under Clinton, grew under Bush, and now it's even getting bigger under Obama, all of these laws that could lead to repression and a severe national security state, I mean, they're saying that they're for other people, and maybe they are, but they're getting worse and worse, this entire homeland security issue. What is your take on that?
Anybody who understands the history of America and the willingness of the American people over time to trade safety and security, or even spurious safety and security for freedom, could have seen this coming in the wake of 2001, September 11th. I think a lot of it is really troubling, especially in an internet age when it's so much easier to tap into what people are reading, what people are saying to one another, where people are traveling, and all the rest. I honestly don't see this getting any better in the foreseeable future. I think September 11th casts such a long shadow that for at least a generation, Americans will be willing to go along with what they think follows from those actions in terms of national security.
Well, that's what the American public is doing, but what are they doing at the national level continuing to institute this? Do you have any clue? Do any of your contacts have any clue?
First of all, let's take as gospel, because I think it is, that American politicians are always one election cycle behind the American people. That's why it took them so long to figure out that most Americans were opposed to the Iraq war continuing. It's taken them just as long to figure out the same thing on Afghanistan. I think it's taken them that long to figure out the same thing on gay marriage. And so I think that in Washington, a lot of this continues to get traction because the perception is this is what the American people want to be safe. And it's going to take a long time for the guys in Washington who tend to be so disconnected from real on-the-ground public opinion to change their minds about doing that.
Could it also have something to do with the Washington echo chamber and the power of Fox News within the echo chamber?
I don't think it has anything to do with Fox News. I think it has everything to do with the Washington echo chamber. I mean, it's really unfortunate that those guys get there and all they hear is received opinion. And you know that because if you go down there as a columnist and you go to dinner parties and cocktail parties, you hear the same tired, bromides about every issue being passed around from journalist to senator to lobbyist to staff member. I remember once, actually I was down there the day the Lewinsky story broke, and I came back home and said the president will be out within 2 weeks. And my husband said to me, take a deep breath. You've been in Washington. The president is not going anywhere. And it was a real reality check to go from a place where everybody was positive they knew what was going to happen politically to a place where an ordinary guy said to me, no, 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 this is not how the rest of the world thinks. And that's the biggest problem with the disconnect between Washington and what's really happening in America.
Well, two pieces of that. One is when I spoke with Gail Collins about the Times support and her support for the war in Iraq. Going, it was so obvious here on the West Coast that it was insane, that it was crazy, that Saddam Hussein probably didn't have anything, and even if he did, why would we want to involve ourselves in this never-ending horror story? And all she could say was mea culpa.
Let the record reflect that as a columnist, I was opposed from the very beginning.
But the other one was Molly Ivins said to me, I think it was in our last interview, that she had always been talking about this Beltway echo chamber, and then she went there for 2 weeks. She said within 2 weeks I was spewing the same garbage and I had to get out.
That's the most dangerous thing, that you really drink the Kool-Aid when you go there, that you really people say things to you at parties or in offices, and it sounds profound and important and resonant, and then you examine it in the light of day, usually when you're on the metro line or going back to New York, and think, but that's not true. It's amazing how it attaches, and it's one reason why I'm glad that I always worked out of New York City.
Is it better than to, when reading columnists, bloggers, or pundits, to keep your eye on where they're situated?
I just think it's really important to read as many as you can. I mean, you mentioned Fox News. I watch Fox News with some regularity because I think that if you're an American liberal, it's really important to know what the opposition is saying. You know, the preaching to the choir aspect of our political process is not helpful in being an engaged citizen. Look, we have a historic opportunity to be well informed. An American today can be better informed than at any time in American history because you can call upon so many different outlets and venues and compare and contrast. You can be your own aggregator. You got to do the work, but when you do, it makes it possible for you to have much more of a 180-degree view of what's going on in the world.
Anna Quinlan, a couple of final questions. First, Hollywood, Meryl Streep worked on One True Thing. And you had two books, Black and Blue and Blessings, came out as TV movies. Anything on any other fronts there?
Every last one has been optioned for a film. Actually, Meryl is executive producing it, which is a first. And they're working on the screenplay now. I don't do that. I'm happy to let somebody else do that who knows how to do it. And I'm hopeful that they can make as good a movie as One True Thing was.
Well, now that you've finished Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, are you working on another novel?
I am. I'm about 70 pages in.
How's
into
it going?
A new novel. I don't know because I sort of had to abandon it for book promotion in January, but I'm done mid-June. I go out to our house in the country where there's nothing to do but write, and I'm hoping to get much deeper into it before Labor Day rolls around.
Do you plan on writing more essays?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. I mean, if you'd asked me when I was here for every last one whether I was going to do any more nonfiction, I probably would have said no. So I think my motto has to be whatever works at any given time. But at this point, my plan is just to write another novel.
Well, I have a suggestion for an essay, if you can sell it, and that's on what we were talking about with the Beltway.
Because it's really powerful.
I think it is.
Yeah. And important.
You've been listening to an interview with Anna Quinlan, whose latest book is Lots of Candy, Plenty of Cake. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.